Fight the Empire.
She's the daughter of God and the source of all protection. Look right now, and you will see she's only here by the skin of her teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life. Hold on, carry it on. Keep saying,
carry it on.
I'm praying,
carry it on.
Keep on praying,
carry it on.
We're saying, come on, come on, keep praying.
I'm
praying,
carry it on.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
It's the Fall KBOO Drive, and our theme is the sounds of democracy. Everything you hear on KBOO is, in its own way, the sound of democracy, because we are a community radio station. Community is one of the most democratic types of media. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members so that we can keep the airwaves democratic and continue to bring you the valuable voices of your community. Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. We're featuring content focused on democracy itself and democratic ideas across the schedule this drive. You can support KBOO by donating right now. Go to kboo.fm/give or on your mobile phone, text KBOO to 44321 or click donate in the KBOO mobile app. Thank you for supporting your community radio station.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 9 a.m. Coming up is Fight the Empire with your host, Per Fagring. So keep it locked here on your community connection.
Good morning. This is Per Fagring, inviting you to Fight the Empire on the People's Radio, KBOO Portland. An interesting discussion in Paul Rowland's show, which if people want to keep that going, we might do that. I noticed that Putin was mentioned, and it might not be a bad idea to think what Russia was like before Putin came to power. At that time, in the from about 1990 on, for about 8 or 9 years, Boris Yeltsin was in charge. And to put it succinctly, Yeltsin kind of gave away the store. His plan was to privatize the Soviet Union, and what happened that under Yeltsin, they sold off all kinds of state assets, which in theory were people's assets, belonged to the people of Russia, sold them all cheap to various money men from around the globe, and who became sort of the oligarchs. And that went on for about, I think, a good 5 years or so. In fact, Yeltsin was reelected in 1996 with a lot of help, interference, if you will, from U.S. Campaign strategists. It kept him in power to continue giving away the store. And this went on for most of that decade, and then fell apart. The situation in Russia got very bad. Life expectancy went down and things like that, and that's when Putin sort of came to power and put an end to that. So, but if people want to talk about that, we could. Also, there was talk about conspiracy theories. You know, there's really nothing very mysterious about conspiracy theories. All over the country, in any city hall in the country, district attorneys are pursuing conspiracy theories, which, when you come right down to it, is just two or more people engaged in some kind of criminal enterprise. And people want to talk about that, that's fine. A thing I was talking about, I sort of planned for today, was this is the 20th year since 9/11, and want to go take us to a to Venice, Florida, which is a quiet little town on the Gulf Coast, about 20 miles south of Sarasota. And back in the summer of 2001, my wife and I were spending a late afternoon in Venice at a place called Sharky's on the Pier, which is a seafood restaurant with a deck in back that overlooked the ocean. So we were sitting at the bar when we noticed a guy at a nearby table glaring our way, and he really looked like he wanted to pick a fight. So we finished our drinks and went on our way. A couple of months later came 9/11 and the attack on the World Trade Center, and the newspapers ran a big page with pictures of all the hijackers. And one of them was the very guy we'd seen at Sharky's, and his name was Mohammed Atta. Well, Atta, by all accounts, was a nasty character. Daniel Hopsicker, in his book Welcome to Terrorland, calls Atta a psychopath and gives some very gory details. But Atta was he was a nasty guy. But his fellow terrorist who was with him was Marwan al-Shehhi, who was kind of a friendly fellow, knew a lot of people in Venice. When we saw them at Sharky's, of course, Atta was glaring our way, but al-Shehhi was having a kind of a friendly conversation with people at the next table. Getting back to Atta being a psychopath, he had an American girlfriend. I think her name was Amanda. And when Amanda dumped him, Atta got his revenge by killing her cat and kittens and chopping up their bodies. And so that's the kind of guy Mohammed Atta was. Venice, Florida is a kind of interesting town. For a quiet town, quite a lot of things are going on. That little airfield was the scene of various CIA operations, and you could see I could see the airfield from my parents' fifth floor apartment, and there's also a steady stream of young men, mostly Arabs, I believe, who were taking flying lessons at some kind of shady flight schools, and then departing. Daniel Hopsicker, he's a TV producer, but he also spends a lot of time in Venice because his parents live there too, and he knows the town well, and also knows that there's still much to uncover. But this is when more information is revealed about Venice, you will be the first to hear about it on Fight the Empire, which is on KBOO, your radio station. And to keep this station going, we depend on you for support. We don't get any big grants from corporations or government. We depend on our listeners. We are a listener-owned and operated radio station. And so we depend on you. Give us a call at 503-231-8187. Once again, that's 503-231-8187. I guess that is a number. If you want to make a contribution, you can also go on the KBOO webpage, and I believe there's some button there that you tick off on called Donate Now. But go to the KBOO webpage. But give us a call at 503-231-8187 for your comments. What do you think Vladimir Putin is up to? Is up to no good, or is he just kind of trying to protect his own interests or the interests of the nation he is in charge of? And, well, so we invite your calls and comments at any time. So getting back to what my original the century that we are now living in, I kind of like to call it the climax century. For a long, long time, civilizations have been around for about 6,000 years. And for a long time, global production was pretty minimal. All through these 6,000 years, from one empire after another, global production kind of stayed kind of pretty far down on the scale. And then, until around 1780 or so, or near the end of the 1700s. All of a sudden, production took an upward climb. And what that was, it was what was called the Industrial Revolution. The world's annual GDP took a steep rise from less than $10 trillion a year to more than $100 trillion. All this in a century or two. And it was based on machines powered by the energy that was stored in coal and then oil. Now, this energy had been stored for millions of years until people learned how to put it to use. And this energy boost is what enabled our modern way of life. But once used, this energy this is gone. Oil and other minerals won't last forever, and so humanity is hoping that renewable resources will keep the good times going. Meanwhile, the planet has heated up and could even become unlivable. Long after the mineral resources are gone, the consequences will stay with us. And so our nation and much of the world is moving toward a future of renewable energy, but the technology requires materials that are not renewable and growing scarce. Solar power requires photovoltaic cells, and wind power uses giant turbines that require manganese and molybdenum and nickel, zinc, and rare earth metals. renewable electricity is stored in batteries using copper. Electric vehicles require cobalt, graphite, lithium, manganese, and rare earths. And it's very interesting about rare earths that most of them right now, I believe, come from China. Right now, the prices are soaring for rare earth materials because of growing demand. And as political and military tensions grow between the U.S. and China, prices for rare earth elements are now soaring, along with the demand for skilled mining workers. That's the story reported in Nikkei Asia. China, which dominates the rare earth industry, is the only country that has a complete supply chain for rare earths, from mining to refining to processing. So at this stage of global development, China is kind of in a very enviable position. I'd like to know what our listeners have to say about this. What do you think? Getting back to what I was going to say about 9/11 and Muhammad Atta, has anybody got anything to say about that? Or if you want to continue the discussion in Paul Rowland's show about, we can keep that discussion going also. The number to call is 503-231-8187. But getting back to the getting back to the elements that our economy requires, you know, most of these materials come from just a few countries. Most of our cobalt comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. China supplies the rare earths. Argentina and Chile produce most of our lithium. An electric car, according to the International Energy Agency, uses six times the materials, or six times the minerals, of the old-fashioned gas guzzler. And this is kind of, when I first read this, this kind of really struck me, that here we are, you know, we talk about the gas-guzzling automobile using up our resources, which it does, mainly oil. But these electric cars, in their own way, they also use up minerals too. And you have to wonder what will it be like when these are gone, which we'll get to in a little bit. But all of these minerals are growing scarce, with peaks sometime in this century. So that's why they call it a climax century, because after years of very low production, production now is soaring at a rapid rate, but the end is in sight within this century, and then reach, I guess, a kind of a crescendo, and then after crescendo, you have a kind of a huge letdown. But oil, on which our economy rests, is totally dependent. There's enough of that for 46 years at current production. Natural gas, there's enough of that for 58 years. Phosphorus could run out as soon as 50 years to 100 years. Then there's aluminum, but there's lots of aluminum or bauxite in the ground, but the mining and smelting use a lot of energy. With coal, there's enough for 188 years, so there's a big supply of coal, but it's terrible for the environment. And so there are 17 rare earth elements. China supplies 97% of them at present, and says they could be gone in as little as 20 years. And so right now the U.S. is kind of frantically trying to boost its own domestic supply of rare earths. Apparently, from what I understand, rare earths are not that. They are kind of scattered all over the earth, planet, but they require a lot of mining and processing to bring them to use. So if you want to give us a call at 503-231-8187. Do you think we are living in a climax century? What do you think will happen after some of these minerals and things that we depend on when they do run out sometime by the end of this century? What comes after our century? Also, if you want to make a contribution to KBOO, which is your radio station, this is a station that keeps democracy alive, give us a call or go to the KBOO webpage and see the ways that you can make your contribution there. We are not doing our old-fashioned, our old-style pledge drives. Kind of miss the pledge drives. They were kind of a lot of fun in a way because everyone would gather in the back room at KBOO, and we'd be taking calls from people, you know, making their pledges, and we had various enticement prizes, and it was kind of like a little party back there, and people all get together who hadn't seen each other for a while. But we're not doing that right now, I guess mainly because of the COVID epidemic. But COVID or not, we need your support to keep this little station operating. So give us a call, 503-231-8187. And this might be a time to say a little bit more about Vladimir Putin, who...
You know, Pear, there's someone who's called. Bruce has wants to pick up the thread you laid down about Mr. Mohammed Atta, I believe.
Oh, okay. We have, I think, Bruce on the line. Good morning, Bruce.
Go ahead, Bruce. You're live.
Yes. This is Christian, seriously. And what I'm trying to do is find a young lady named Tina Rose Hickey.
Oh, whoops. I'm sorry. This should be Bruce.
Yeah, Pierre, that's very interesting about Mohammed Atta and the Florida connection. That's really interesting. There's another thing. Before the lockdown, I was at the library. They've reopened, thankfully. And I was asking about getting... a hold of a San Diego telephone directory, because Al-Midar and Al-Hazmi were apparently listed in that San Diego telephone directory before 9/11. The Florida Sun Sentinel says they were, and I thought it'd always be valuable to get a physical copy or the nearest you could get and see which of those two hijackers... Having been followed from, I believe it was Indonesia, by U.S. intelligence, you know, they know their names, they know they want to get in the United States, and yet they're not able to look in the San Diego directory. Of course, they'd come in through L.A., San Diego, San Francisco. It couldn't have been that hard if you have eyes on them to know that, well, they're in San Diego now and this person's helping them or that person's helping them. I wanted to get your thoughts on that aspect of foreknowledge, monitoring of Atta and the other 18.
Okay, I don't know a whole lot, but I know that apparently when some of these other suspects came to the United States, I think they came through San Diego, And they right away they were kind of sort of received taken under the wing by various people who lived there, and so there was this, I wouldn't call it, I don't know if I call it a network, but there are a lot of people kind of involved in this whole 9/11 thing, and so one would think that this is under that our security organizations would be keeping an eye on these people. They weren't exactly that hidden. They were kind of almost out in the open in many ways, but somehow all the damage they did happened. So that's something I've heard various explanations and stories about that. It's called a conspiracy theories, if you will, but I don't know. I don't really have my mind made up on that, but I'm always interested in finding out more about that.
Well, it is really interesting that you had, you know, physical eye contact with Otta, and it does correspond with Hopsicker's, you know, idea that there was anything but a low profile, and there was anything but a master spy, kind of a Al-Qaeda master spy, sinister Arab network. They were at, you know, having these lap dances and hanging out in these bars and all but getting in fights with innocent tourists, you know. So it's a big wealth of information that Hopsicker, and now with your anecdotal, I mean, well, your eyewitness account is remarkable. So thank you for that. I'll just let you go on with your show.
Okay, I'm glad. You know, I really recommend this book by Daniel Hopsicker. It's called Welcome to Terrorland. Hopsicker is I believe he's a Hollywood TV producer, but he has, at least at that time, he had parents who were still living in Venice, Florida. And so he spent quite a lot of time in Venice. He kind of grew up there. He knew the area pretty well. And I really recommend this book. It's because Mohammed Atta and his companions, they were kind of pretty much out in the open. I mean, they were, you know, they were pretty well known, like Marwan al-Shehhi. Was sort of one of the nicer guys in the crowd. Was, you know, he was pretty well known. Mohammed Atta was just a nasty character. Hopsicker calls him a psychopath, and when you read about him, he certainly was. And so, I really recommend the book. Venice, Florida is kind of an interesting place. A lot of retirees live there, including my own parents. And from their apartment on the fifth floor, you could look out of this little airfield kind of across the road. And there was a couple flying schools there that were operated by two different flying schools operated by two different guys from the Netherlands, two Dutch guys, and who themselves had CIA connections. And so they had these flying schools where, you know, lots of young men would take flying lessons and then go on to whatever activities they were going on to. And so this is kind of very interesting a thing going on in this quiet little town of Venice, Florida. And there had been, I believe this airfield had been used by the CIA for its own operations in the Caribbean. And so, anyway, I think we're getting near the end of our half hour here. But this book by Daniel Hopsicker, I think, is really well worth reading. And so it's gives you an idea of the things that go on in small, little quiet towns like Venice, Florida. Hard to, you know, when you think of it, here is a town where full of kind of retired Americans enjoying the sunshine and the beaches. At the same time, there's these little clandestine operations and some actual vicious killers operating, all kind of all together, all at once in this little town of Venice, Florida. So, with that, it's been good talking with you and hearing your call. So, stay tuned to KBOO. It's your station, and we are in a fun drive. We need you to keep this station operating. It's a station kind of by and for you, the people. So give us a call, 503-231-8187. So it's been Per Fogering and Fight the Empire. Keep on fighting the empire.